Whether you keep them in your home or love to see them in theirs, these are the creatures that bring us all together.
Reptiles. We're going to be delving into the experiences of reptile lovers from around the block and around the world. This is the Reptile Talk Podcast.
What's going on?
Sorry.
Turchin from Brassman Reptiles.
And I'm Rob, and I'm creeping it real. What is so funny, man? I don't understand.
All I'm just going to suggest to our audio-only listeners that they just go to YouTube for the first 15 or 20 seconds of this podcast. And you'll understand why I can't finish a complete sentence.
Why you're laughing at all the intros.
Oh, wow.
What's up, Jeremy? How you doing?
I'm great, man. I'm fucking amazing. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm in the middle of juggling some enclosures because I got some black box cages coming here very shortly. And so I thought I could get all of my cage and furniture juggling all done before we started today, but I didn't. So I have cages strewn about and scrubs next to my bathroom and like all over the freaking place. So I'm okay. I'm okay. So how are you doing?
You're just moving around a reptile room, bro. That's
yes. Yeah. That's basically what it comes to.
I'm doing good, man. Today was a chill, low key day. I finally found a medicine regimen with my allergy meds that allows me to rest at night and breathe throughout the day. So I'm freaking thankful for that, because holy Christ, just been beating my ass, man. Like, you have no freaking idea. But outside of that, no complaints. Amazons have been locking up, which is super exciting. Had a couple ball pythons do some prelay shed stuff. And colubrids have started to pair up, which is fun.
Hey,
should have some corn, some Mexican black kings, maybe North Mexican pine snakes, maybe.
It's a Jedi action.
Yeah, a little bit. And I think I've now pulled the 10th clutch of leopard gecko eggs for the season. For these projects with Mark. So that's pretty fun. And yeah, so I can't complain, dude.
That's tight.
I'm dude, and
before we get too deep into it, wanted to say that tonight's episode is brought to you by Black Box Cages.
That's right.
Our sponsor, and then they're also a sponsor for the other network that we're having a crossover episode with tonight.
That's it.
Tonight we have a very special guest, someone who's very near and dear to my heart. We have Mr. Phil Wolf from the Nephrus Initiative and from the Herpeticulture Podcast and Herpeticulture Network, or Snakes and Stokies.
Let's get him on here. What up, dude?
Salutations.
The sounds of smooth jazz and the soft voice of Phil Wolf.
And Batman.
I'm sick and I'm Batman. cigarettes and geckos, right?
Hell yeah.
Oh man, what's up, boys?
Dude, it's been going pretty good. Today I caught a five line skink and a DK snake at work, so hey, I can't complain.
Dude, who's better than you?
Dude, I
herping living on the it job. Up. I love it.
Legit, getting paid, baby.
Paid to herp.
It's good.
You know, I tell the customers, I'm like, I'm doing a very thorough inspection right now. I'm going above and beyond. Oh, look, a snake. Yeah.
That's it. Oh, awesome. Gosh. Just start recommending to your customers that they throw like plywood or tin down in their yard.
I actually had to tell someone not to do that because they had a giant piece of tin in the, like right next to their house, and they have like a 1-year-old. And when I went in to do their service, the wife was wearing one of the green EcoWear hats. This one actually with the copperhead on the top. And I was like, oh damn, I had that exact hat. That's so cool. I saw the tin on the side of your house. So like, how into snakes are you guys? And they're like, oh, we don't like snakes. I just bought this hat at like a museum because I didn't, it was really sunny that day. So I bought this hat and I was like, oh, well, you might want to get rid of that tin on the side of your house because it's going to produce some snakes. And when I came back like 6 months later, giant, like 2.5-3 foot copperhead underneath it. I was like, you guys should really get rid of that tin, man.
Nice.
Yep.
Yeah. What can I say?
The biggest letdown ever. Like,
what are the fine for me, man?
No. I'm yes for you, but I'm speaking like as far as like the conversation with that customer.
Oh yeah, yeah.
What are the odds of you wearing an EcoWear hat and not being into reptiles? Like,
yeah, it's crazy.
Especially the copperhead one.
Yeah, jeez. Right.
So, Phil, for the people who listen to us who might not know your background, what's like an abridged version of where what brought you up to where you're at right now? Or you can give us the full version.
Berms.
Of you are and what you're doing. No.
Yeah. We don't have one of those. No. Giant swamp pythons. No. I've been doing this a long time. I kind of dove headfirst about 20 years ago working for some importer, exporter, wholesaler type stuff. And I've been fell in love, man. Just like you guys, when we're kids, we start small and it just gets bigger and better. And you get a grown up and you get a paycheck and you're like, man, I can have the world, right? Why not learn as much as I can? And a few years ago, I linked up with Justin Smith from the Herpetoculture Network, as it's called now. And we started a show called Snakes and Stogies. And then that just blossomed. And then working with the THP boys and girls. And then later on, my good friend Nipper Reed in London, we got together and started Venom Exchange Radio, which is basically an all venomous podcast. And yes. Here I am. that's the abridged version, right?
Yes.
And at some point, meeting you two. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. At some point along the way, running into both of you, and the rest is history, as they say.
Hey, exactly.
Today's episode has been brought to you by Random Dancing.
So yes. Random head undulations. I'll take random neck movements for 500, Rob.
For 500.
This is why we're friends, right?
This is it.
Forget the snakes. Forget the lizards. This is it.
The neck undulations.
Neck undulations.
They bring people together.
It does. It does. Fun for the whole family.
Oh my lord.
So, Phil, I did want to touch on a few different things on our podcast tonight, but. Yeah. Jeremy and I worked at New England Reptile for a while. I'm sure the people who are listening know that. And so we saw like a lot of crazy, unusual stuff come through there and got experience with a lot of different species in working there. What was that like for you working at like an import-export facility and getting your legs, so to speak, with a lot of the stuff they got going on there?
Well, I realized that it takes a lot to do that, like to have a facility like that. You need different people that have different specialties. And then a lot of people, they learn as they go. And I was one of those people that I knew enough to get in trouble, but I really had that thirst for knowledge to just learn as much as I can. And there's no better way to diversify the herpetological knowledge base than to work or interact with a facility much as Nerd or Strictly or Underground or Blackwater or any of these big companies. And it was a wild ride, a lot of fun, a lot of jokes, a lot of hard work, seeing specimens that you'd never thought you'd ever see. Mm-hmm. Seeing people come in to a horse trough with 1,000 baby ball pythons and just having this one guy, you never seen him before, this little old guy, and he's just picking up every single baby ball looking for this one individual scale. And then he comes back 2 years later, he's like, hey, remember that little ball python I got with little zigzag on the side? Guess what that turned into? And it's the next morph. So aside from seeing things like that develop and evolve, it was super cool to interact with as many species as I did. So in Florida, for having venomous reptiles, it used to be a lot more lax. Now it's very, very strict in terms of the amount of hours you need, in terms of the amount of experience that you have to gain for the different types of venomous as the state classifies them. But back then, it was kind of just get your hours. You needed 1,000 hours at the time. You had to do it for a year. So I got to work with the coolest species on the planet. Just and yes, they weren't mine, but I got to interact with them and work with them and learn from experts and gain that knowledge base that only makes you a better keeper, only makes you a better herper. And I wouldn't have changed it for anything, man. It was awesome.
Dude, hell yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question or not, but sorry.
No, it definitely did. Getting to experience so many different species, like a lot of people don't understand, or it's hard for them to conceptualize the idea that, you know, if you work with somebody who breeds ball pythons, you'll get really good at like palpating ball pythons and, you know, changing your water dishes, using your protocol, doing this, that, and the other thing. But when you are working with 50 species every single day, and there's like 10 different kinds of parameters. Yeah. You know, you learn a lot, and it pushes you to figure things out in a way that, you know, working with one species or two species just will never do.
Yeah. And the ability to interact with animals that normal people wouldn't necessarily get the ability to, like, you guys have worked with divergens. Like, I've never seen one in person. So that, to me, like, that's super cool. I'm not even a big Boyga guy, but just the fact that you guys got to interact with them and learn from Kevin and kind of learn what's been learned already, and then do some trial and error, kind of learn as you go with that genera, is super fascinating, you know. And I'm envious of both of you just for that one species, let alone the countless others you guys got to work with.
Yeah,
bro, it's hard for people to like conceptualize, like I said, it's just hard for people to conceptualize how many different species a place like that takes in and works with each year. And you know, there's only so many hours in the day, there's only so many things you can you know, learn about. And when you're dealing with imports and establishing things and doing stuff like that, it definitely gives you this ability to learn a whole lot in a relatively short period of time, you know.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Absolutely. I do miss those divergents too. They're such a freaking cool snake.
Yeah. A buddy of mine down by me, he's got them and he's working on breeding them, but I haven't had time to go see them. But hopefully he gets to produce some, because we need more of them in the country. We definitely do.
You should 100%. Do it. You should check them out.
Yeah, you definitely should take that trip, man. It'd be so freaking worth it.
Yeah.
A lot of them are prettier when they're babies or when they're younger. And then they, you know, they are not quite as, like, to me, they're just not as eye-grabbing as when they're older. Like the Latifasciata, bro.
Yeah.
Those things are phenomenal. No, yeah. Those things, like, really are striking when you get to like see him up close.
Yeah. And a good friend of ours, Jeff Frederick, who might be listening, might not, he urges me to always throw in some common names too. So we're talking about the Philippines cat-eyed snake, for those listening.
Oh yeah, like the Luzon blue cat-eyed Luzon snake blue, or whatever. I don't know what the other
I feel Jeff over my shoulder yelling at me. So
English.
It'd be my mom. She's always telling me that. She's like, dumb it down. Make it like dumb it down.
Yeah.
That's why I like listening to Snakes and Stogies and like the Herpeticulture Network and the Venomous Exchange Radio, is because you guys go deeper into using Latin names and things like that. And I feel like it's just that little bit deeper that if you've got a good base knowledge, it's really, really, like, I don't know, it's more connective for me when I'm listening to it, as opposed to just listening to stuff that just uses the common names.
Hey, it's cool, man, until you get the one thing that's like green rat snake.
Which one?
Bush snake. Yeah, which one, right? But I appreciate that sincerely. I do.
Yeah, they're like, oh, a vine snake, and I'm like, you mean like Aetula or Prasinus? Are you talking about Oxybanus? Like, what are we getting at here?
Yeah, there was just one of the South African guys did a poll on Instagram, and it was like, what common name should you use for this? And it was Teletornis, which we always call them twig snakes, but I guess mm-hmm. there's certain parts of South Africa they call them vine snakes, but they have yep. another snake that they call vine snakes. So it's like mm-hmm. which one's gonna melt you from the inside and which one's just gonna look nasty.
Yeah.
And these are the real questions.
Right. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Man.
Were there any species that you got in back then that you were like, oh man, I really need this, but you just like were not able to keep your hands on them?
Yeah, there was a lot of species. So the majority of the time when I worked the import export stuff, it was venomous, and and there were several species that I didn't buy for myself because I was like, oh, they'll come in again next year. You know, I'll get the next shipment. And some of them I did take home, and some of them I just kept there as pets. Some of them I bought them. I kept them there as pets just so I could maintain them every day when I'm at work. And I was like, you know what? It's been 6 months. Let's get them to a new home. Let someone else experience them. So like, Atheris hispida, the hairy bush viper, I kept one alive that looked like a death's door. I kept it alive for like 6 months, and I realized that I was spending a lot of money in green tree frogs to feed this thing. So I said, you know what, let me get rid of it. And I regret that species. I should have kept that, and I should have documented everything. I should have taken photos and video, and just for almost like a citizen science kind of way, because I'm not that educated, but every little bit of information that we can record as herpetoculturists could benefit these animals in some way or another. So that's one species off the top of my head that I remember. And honestly, death adders, because we got in so many Indonesian locality death adders, and damn, they were cheap, man. I think I paid my first pair of blue Lavis, the smooth death adders, I paid like $80 each. And, you know, so and you kept them for a few months, and then all of a sudden a batch of red ones would come in and go, you know what, let me sell the blue ones, I'll keep the red ones for a little bit. And 6 months later, you get rid of those, and now they're just unobtainium. So things like that. Definitely
damn,
have no regrets,
it hurts. But, yeah. Bro, I was at Willie Beard's place, Venom Central, this past weekend.
Yeah,
in great South Carolina. And dude, I wish I had taken more. I was like mingling and talking with people, and I wish I had gotten like better shots of the enclosures, because these enclosures were phenomenal. And they like the Gaboon exhibit, I think it was like 8 foot by 10 foot by 5 foot tall. It was massive. Yeah. And it had windows on both sides, so you could like go around it and see both sides.
That's awesome.
It was so freaking, and like the Lachesis, the Melanocephala, bro, same thing. Huge, giant enclosures. I wish I had taken more pictures that really like showed that off, because it's like, it was phenomenal. But we were, to bring it back to what we were talking about, the death adders, we were talking about that, and I was like, bro, I remember when Levis used to come in all the freaking time. And then I was talking to some people who were dealing with imports and exports, and they were like, oh yeah, one of the guys who was like one of their exporters out there who like regularly collects things like that, he got killed by one. And so now all the guys are like afraid of that, so they don't want to collect them anymore.
Wow, that's wild, man. And see, I heard a very different story of the islands where they're found are so remote that it's not monetarily beneficial,
advantageous for them to go out there.
For them to go all the way out there. And then when they do, they get way more money from Europe than they do from us. So it's kind of like, who's going to pay more? And then the stuff just dries up, so to speak. So
damn.
That I believe damn. That story too. I'm sure there's multiple avenues, you know?
Yeah. Sheesh. Sheesh. I love death adder. It's something serious. And I have not been able to get any or keep them or work with them. So eventually that's on my list. They're so cool. Yeah, man,
for sure. For sure. And right now I keep with the exception of some North American colubrids, it's almost everything I have is exclusively arid desert and steppe land, grassland animals. So there's very few tropical species that I would consider, and they're definitely still on my radar. I'll make a tropical exception for them.
You know? That's fair. Yeah. That's a good one.
But yeah, man, that facility you went to, that guy's top notch, man. And a good close friend of mine, he actually has a pair of Urutus from him. And stellar specimens.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, crazy snakes.
And he's got two different lines. He's got two different localities. He's got those like silver and black ones, and then he's got ones that are like a tan and black too that I got to check out while I was there. And man, they are phenomenal. They're so cool, man.
Super cool. Super cool.
Just like you wouldn't think that they're Bothrops if you just saw like a picture of them with no context, you know?
Yeah. And I can't fathom seeing one in the wild, just like in the leaf litter.
Oh my
just,
gosh. Yeah.
Like, you know, moonlight shining through, you know, how we fantasize, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. In reality, it's in a little trash pile behind the local bar. It's like a little pile of them.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's like for a while, I went, my buddy and I, Henry, we imported an Indonesian shipment and I got in a bunch of black purple maculatus, the shore pit viper. Yeah. And most of them were real rich, dark black, if not super dark purple with the red eyes. And I set
red
them
eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. And almost every single picture on iNaturalist is that specimen from that locality with like a natty ice can in the background, you know, or like a styrofoam cup next to the snake. And it's like, well, this is where they live. This is their ecosystem. So we basically determined that they are the cottonmouths of the Malay Peninsula.
Bro, that's hilarious.
There's only two snakes that will live in or around an empty natty ice can, and that's purple maculatus and cottonmouth.
That is so painfully accurate. It hurts.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
Oh, thank you.
Oh my god. Oh, that's fucking great, man. Shit.
Oh man.
Okay, so you said that you worked with the Hispida before. That's like a lot of people's holy grail, the Atheris, even though I don't think they're as cool as some of the other species, but they are they're unique, but they don't get very big, right? They're like one of those ones that gets like 18 inches, if that.
Yeah, the biggest one we ever brought in was probably about 18 to 20 inches, and yeah. they're very lean. They're only about as thick as your pinky. And I know there's a lot of people that have been seeing them in the wild lately on ecotours, which is fantastic. Sadly to say that there's also a lot of rumor of them being staged because they are becoming scarcer and scarcer. They're a very, very cool species. I feel like they're one of the more intelligent of the bush viper family, of that Atheris or Atheris bush viper family. But they're almost exclusively amphibian and snail eaters. Yeah. So it's very difficult to turn them onto rodents. I never even tried because I knew it was just going to be a stretch. Yeah. I feel like if more people had the ability to keep them nowadays, the mindset, the mantra is very different than it was 15-20 years ago was let's keep it alive. Now it's let's eliminate the stress factor, let's give it more of what its ecosystem actually is. And our mindset has evolved to that point where I feel like if people got them now, they would do a better job than we did 20 years ago.
Yeah, especially with the amount of frogs that are being captive bred right now. I bet you could get like 500 frozen frozen White's tree frog tadpoles for relatively cheap, or you know, Pac-Man pixie frog tadpoles too. You know, if you really wanted to, you could get those sort of things and supplement your feeding or use it for scenting or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. People are very apprehensive to use pet animals as feeders, and mm-hmm. we've talked about on some of the other shows, you know, crested geckos are so prolific that mm-hmm. I'm sure at some point we may get to an area where we can have hatchling cresteds as feeders, whether they be frozen or live or what have you. And I know that's a taboo thing to say, but having the mindset of these animals could be commercialized in a farming role. And that's not to take away from crested geckos. I love geckos. I'm a gecko fanatic. Or even like binos geckos. For the longest time, I was trying to find binos geckos to feed to knobtails because mm-hmm. I know that in the wild, that's what they eat. The adult amii in the central red center of Alice Springs, Uluru, all that jazz, they're eating wild bino geckos in the wild because mm-hmm. they're big enough to do it. So I feel like there is a way to jump into that more naturalistic feeding for some of these harder to keep or more, I don't want to say exotic or more eclectic species. I used to keep Cossus, the genus Cossus, which is the snouted night adders, small terrestrial mm-hmm. vipers from sub-Saharan Africa. And I almost exclusively fed them green tree frogs. And I know this is going to sound taboo, but we wound up getting Florida green tree frogs, and we would basically euthanize them like we euthanize rats, and then we would freeze them inside of a plastic wrap, and that way you can almost roll it out like wax paper and then just pop off a frozen frog, thaw it out, and then go from there. And I feel like had I not done that, there's no way I could have kept that genera in captivity. It just wouldn't have worked. So I feel like we're at a point now in herpetoculture where the mindset has evolved to be more naturalistic and give the animal more of a stress-free environment, more replicant to what they're living in the wild, and hopefully be able to provide them the prey items that they actually desire or would instinctually need, opposed to just forcing a rat down its throat.
I think also it goes past just what they would instinctually want, but also like the health benefits
of
eating what they should be eating versus what we force them to eat. You know, like I had a really lengthy conversation, Tinley, with Ron St. Pierre, and I know he just did a podcast with MJ, and he was talking about his regurgitation issue and his thought process on the rats that they primarily eat being fruit eating rats versus the rats that we feed them here in the States, which are more grain fed, and how the potential of the lower GI tract inflammation that causes them to regurge coming from irritation from the grain that those rodents are being fed. You know, we're talking about imported animals that would be eating these fruit eating rodents.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, it's interesting when you start to break down some of these more taboo barriers into certain species, even something as common as an emerald tree boa, but start thinking about it differently and see what kind of strides you can make in appropriate husbandry along the way. So I think it's important now that we have stuff like crested geckos that are produced by literally the tens of thousands. You know, like there is no reason we can't be, you know, reaching out to folks like Anthony Caponetto and being like, hey man, I know you got 10,000 low-end crested geckos, like let's make something happen, you know. But to satisfy that, like I know somebody who used baby crested geckos to get a green tree python to start feeding.
You know,
so I mean it does work and it is possible, you know. But I agree, that's the like the next layer of taboo that exists already within our circle. You know, it's like, you can't feed that, it's cute, I love it, it's my gecko friend. And it's like,
but it goes, we always talk about Steve Rinella's cute and cuddly theory, you know. You can't hunt bears because they're cute and cuddly. You can't hunt wolves because they're cute and cuddly. But what happens is the environment that we've, you know, contained for them, they're now ruining everything else because no one's managing them, because they're not being taken care of one way or another. So it goes, like Steve Rinella's cute and cuddly theory, don't feed my cute crested gecko off because it's cute. Well, how about this? Why don't we start with every single frog butt, which by the way, my favorite kind of crested gecko is the frog butt. Why don't we freeze their tail? People throw the tail away.
Freeze
the tail. Now you can use that tail. You can blend it and puree it and make it into a liquid additive to put as a scenting tool, or even chop it up into smaller pieces and use that as a scent incentive for certain species. So I don't know. I think we diverted on this conversation slightly, but
well, one of the species I think that gets overlooked, or maybe it's just because there isn't as many people producing them now as there was at one time, but the Pictus geckos, they reproduce at such a rapid rate. one of my friends, Rich Sawtell, who's in Florida now, he's like, these things breed like crickets. He's like, I literally have to throw away eggs because and when they're born, they're like so, so small that even baby Candoia and things like that would be able to eat them.
Sure.
And he was like, these are like the perfect feeder. And he was like, yeah, if somebody was wanting a good solid lizard feeder, you know, the adults are, you know, what, 3.5 inches small adult leopard gecko size. And then the babies are microscopic. Really, they're so incredibly small when they're born, but they do grow rapidly. So it's like one of those things where if you are dedicated to working with a more unusual species that may have a more particular diet, exploring different avenues like that could be ways to get these things established. And then as we get them more established, then, you know, generations down the line, maybe they can change up what they're being fed. But in the meantime, getting them established and making sure that there is a captive breeding population of them, you got to do what you got to do to make sure that those animals are doing well. It's not about, one of the things that I think about all the time is it's not about what I want for the animal, it's what the animal wants. Because so many people are like, well, I want to put this thing in a 10-foot by 6-foot enclosure. And I'm like, okay, but does your snake want to be in a 10-foot by 6-foot enclosure? Like, is that going to stress it out? They're like, it's a Calabar burrowing python. Of course it wants to be in a 10-by-6. And I'm like, oh man. Arboreal Calabar burrowing python. I understand.
It was in a tree once. Therefore, the whole species.
My father hung me on a hook once. But going back to Ron St. Pierre, man, I mean, talk about a guy who's dialed in. You know, his Emerald program is incredible. And I had no idea about the rodents eating the fruits, but I remember there was a I don't know if it was a study or just like a show or something, but there was some mammal in some smaller arboreal mammal that was in a rainforest, and they were chopping down a particular type of tree for lumber, what have you. Mm-hmm. And they were noticing that the mammals were disappearing, excuse me. And they started to catch them and weigh them and take blood. And they're basically figuring out that they're surviving on the food that's there, but they're not getting the sugars that they would normally get from the particular nuts of those trees. So talking about like the rodents that eat fruit opposed to rodents that are eating a fairly grain-based diet, the emeralds may need some kind of sugar or some kind of glucose level that we're not even on that same wavelength. Right. And I think about those arboreal mammals, you know, bush babies or whatever the hell they were. Mammals are not my forte, but just on a caloric and nutrition level, how is that affecting what we're doing? You know, and we talk about people that feed king cobras rodents, and look, I know it works. I know guys that do it. They trick them into eating it, or they acclimate them to eat rodents, but most of them don't live a full life because it's just too much protein. It's too much fat. It's too much fur, whatever it may be. And they usually die young. So I know I'm preaching the choir with you guys being people that have kept kings before, but I really like what you went with the fruit. That's super fascinating. I got to hit up Ron about that. That's cool.
Yeah, it was when we spoke at Tinley, he brought it up, and I said to him, I'm like, man, you know, there's very few people that really like push me to think about the, first of all, captive husbandry, like taking that to the next level of certain species, but also like really thinking about where the animals come from. Yeah. And the full like pyramid breakdown, like what that looks like. And I was like, you have consistently been that guy. But it's really interesting to think about. And I mean, I think about that, you know, you mentioned king cobras, think about even stuff like the Asian vine snakes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I feel like there's a lot of species that for the most part kind of fly under the radar. You know, because maybe you can get them to take rodents or whatever, but, you know, they would thrive or live a more full life if we fed primarily that more naturalistic diet. So,
yeah.
I think that plays a huge role in keeping and producing them successfully in captivity, but also, like, I think that's one of the next layers that's going to push captive herpetoculture forward in the US, you know, is like finally breaking down some of these barriers and being like, okay, yes, I love my crested gecko, but you know what? I'm going to have a trio of these myself to produce my own feeders, you know, especially when we're talking about an animal that, you know, as far as expense goes, is very minimal.
Yeah,
you know, you're talking about, you know, I'm just gonna go get some crest gecko diet and I'm good. You know, it costs me $15 every 3 months, and I'm pretty freaking good. Like, there's no reason why we can't start kind of breaking down those barriers to be able to make a lot larger strides towards keeping some of these more niche species longer in captivity and establishing hopefully healthy captive generations of them in the future.
Hell yeah. I'm with it 1,000%.
We literally had a woman at Nerd. Well, she's a customer that came into the pet store all the time, and she had an Aetula prasina vine snake. She had it for over, I think she said, the last time I spoke to her, she was like, yeah, it's like she's had it for 12 years now.
Wow.
And she would come in and she'd get, you know, anoles to feed it every other week or so. And then she would supplement with feeder fish. And she's just like, it's the same cost as getting like a large rat. You know, it's right around the same price as getting a large rat. If I was feeding it to, you know, a python or a boa, and people think, oh, well, I got to feed a lizard, it's going to be so expensive. And it's like, how much are you really spending on a large, extra large rat for your, you know, adult python compared to what a feeder anole is going to be? And it's right around the same price. And so she actually really had it now for 12 years, bro.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's crazy. Wild. Wild. I love it. Yeah.
And she had like a fully planted paludarium. So she had like a water feature in the bottom and vines and all the crazy, you know, it's crazy.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the next level, you know, but it's cool to see the random pet keeper that does just that little extra bit of research, you know, to figure out, okay, well, what does this animal really need to eat? Number one. And then number two, to sit there and do a financial breakdown to make that make sense. Like most of them are like, no, man, it's feeder lizards. You know, lizards are too expensive. It's going to be terrible. But, you know, the reality is when you go to a retail pet shop and a small rat is $6.99, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, well, that $4.99 and old doesn't seem that bad.
And she's like, just pick out the fattest, chunkiest one you got in there.
There you go.
Is what it is. So, hey, you know.
Just grab a friend, drive down to Florida, just get a butterfly net and drive real close to the edge of the road.
All the brown anoles, baby.
There you go, dude.
All the ones you can catch. As many as you can fit in a bag.
Yeah, if it's not lime green, fair game.
Take it.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Oh, man. Dude.
So you have got a phenomenal venomous collection, and you are working with with the Venomous Exchange Radio, and I have a passion for venomous snakes as well. So I do love listening to the Venomous Exchange Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you're within earshot and you're listening to this right now, you should go listen to it because it's got some really incredible information and good conversations if you're curious venomous snakes. And you have a deep-seated love for all things African when it comes to venomous snakes. So we can't go the episode without talking about some African venomous snakes.
Yeah, it's rock and roll. I'm all about it, man. The Dark Continent calls to me. I don't know what it is, man. The history, the people, just it, everything about it. I love everything about it, man. The culture itself and the evolution of the culture and the animals within that culture, everything from the python worshipers in the West Coast to, you know, the Germans in East Africa reclassifying animals because they realized that this one doesn't look like this one. And it's absolutely fascinating. And I do love desert stuff. And so the MENA region, as we call it, you know, Middle East, North Africa, I've been trying to get as many of those species as I can just because it's fairly simple in their husbandry, very Euromastics, if you will. So I got a nice little eclectic group of stuff and who knows what the future holds. So, but yeah, I'm all about the African snakes, man, especially the venomous.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. I mean, there's so much draw when it comes to the African species. You know, if you ask a random reptile person what their favorite venomous snake is, I would say that probably like 80% of people are going to say gaboons. Based on the amount of people that I've talked to, gaboon vipers just hold people's attention for some reason more than everything else. And I personally don't understand it, but I hear that it's a thing, you know? There's so many cool
coming from the guy who likes blood pythons. You're like, yeah, I don't know why people don't like the fat sausage thing or do like the fat sausage.
It's one thing to be a fat sausage, but why have a fat sausage that is brown when you can have a fat sausage that's neon green, red, and blue? Like, come on. What is this? I don't understand.
Yeah. I'm with you, man. The Bitis or Bitis genus is a fantastic gateway drug to venomous, man, because most of them don't get more than 20 inches long. So as long as you can afford the price tag, they're fairly easy to keep in captivity. They make great venomous snakes to keep in captivity. I can't afford some of the more unique ones, but I keep puffs, I keep gaboons, and I hope to breed Cape puffs this year, so that'll be happy. And if it sticks. And I like the Cape puff locality because the more southwest you go, they're typically a smaller snake. Puff adders, I'm pretty sure, talking to Steven Spalls, said that it's the most fecundity of any land vertebrate. I think the record's like 163 babies in one litter, something like that.
Oh my god!
Yeah, I know. He had said that he had a female Tanzanian puff that had dropped 150 offspring one time.
Wow!
It's actually on the back of the cover of his book, Sun, Sand, and Snakes. But the Cape puffs, the ones on the southwest corner by Cape Town, they only have usually less than 20. So hoping for that.
Far more reasonable. Yeah.
Much better.
Oh my gosh.
Dude, that's wild. I mean, I remember that talking to Timmy and Kevin up at Nerd, they said that they had bred their puffs once, you know, a long time ago, and their female dropped, like, I think they said 40 or 50 babies at the time. And that's like a fairly average number for you know, a good sized adult female. It's wild.
Yeah. I do think it's crazy how as many people love gaboon vipers, they don't really know that there's two different species. There's an East Coast and a West Coast. Oh
my goodness. It's frustrating. Bittis rhinoceros, Bittis gabonica.
One's got horns, one doesn't.
So. I was recently at the Louisville Zoo in Kentucky. And they had a huge East African gaboon on display. And I was like, oh, cool, a gaboon. And then I looked at the eye stripes and I was like, oh, a gaboon. Like, oh, this is much more interesting now.
Yeah, man, for sure. For sure.
Oh, man.
It's, people are just, they just don't know. They're just like, oh, it's a gaboon viper. It's a gaboon viper. It's a gaboon viper. It's a gaboon viper. And I'm like, oh, maybe not. Maybe not, though.
Right. Have you ever tried? No.
Actually, I remember going to Hamburg Expo in Pennsylvania and seeing like a sweater box, and it was filled all the way. You know, it's a sweater box. It's what, 8 inches deep, and it was filled almost top to bottom and the whole way around with the gaboon viper, and its head was like almost as big as my hand, and I don't have small hands. And I was like, how the hell did you get this in the box? I don't understand. This thing is like, it fills up the entire box. How did you get it in there?
Very carefully, Rob. Very carefully.
Very carefully. And they're lucky that gaboons are, on average, pretty docile and amenable to being handled, you know?
Yes. They're tolerant until they're not.
Exactly. Right. And when they're not, oh my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
I think that one of the things that, you know, when people are like, oh man, I would love to get a gaboon viper, I wish that they could see an adult gaboon viper before they buy it. Because then you see a little gaboon viper at a show, you're like, oh, this is pretty cool. Or you see like even like a 2.5 foot gaboon viper, you're like, oh, you know, that's a good size viper. They don't see the ones that are like as big as a loaf of bread and like, you know, 4 foot long. They don't see those.
Yeah.
And they can become quite the hefty snake. And I feel like a lot of people are not prepared for a, you know, loaf of bread, 10 pound, 12 pound, highly toxic, you know, giant head, giant venom glands, big fangs. Like, it's not a beginner species of venomous snake, you know?
No, not at all. And in the past, the West Africans were brought in by the bushel, and they were so cheap. I think wholesale was like $75.
Retail was
like $125.
Yep.
And a lot of people that got into venomous, or they were getting their hours, or they were getting their tutelage through mentorship. And one of the first species they get is they get a baby gaboon because it's cute and it's easy to feed. They're very hardy animals. They're very forgiving animals in terms of husbandry. And then they realize after 1, 2, 3 years of taking care of this neonate that it's kind of a boring species, and although they are very aesthetically pleasing, I admit I have one just to have one. There's no, yeah. It doesn't really interact well. It doesn't want to be messed with. It kind of just sits there. So it's a very unexciting animal after long term, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But they are super cool.
Yeah. But I wish that also people who are getting into venomous, that's why I think it's important that people have a mentor so that they can get some experience and get some. What's the word? Not hindsight, but like some insight into things like that. And then also feeding, because until you've seen a Gaboon Viper strike at a prey item, I don't think you can comprehend how quickly they look very unassuming. And when they're moving about, they move pretty slow most of the time. When there is food involved, they are like grease lightning. They're so fast, you don't even see it move. I remember the first time that I saw one strike in person, I was like, I didn't even see that the strike was coming. It was there, and then it was on the rat.
Oh, damn. Gosh.
That's a good-sized fang.
Yeah, I wasn't ignoring it. I was trying to find the photo, but I've actually got a bigger fang. It's a solid 2 inches long, but...
Yeah.
Dude. No. Yeah. Sheesh.
Oh man.
I remember pulling a fang out of one of the enclosures at Nerd, and I was like, is that a fang in there? And so when we were taking them out to do our cleaning, I like went in immediately and I grabbed it. I was like, this is a fang, and I put it next to one of the rattlesnake fangs from like a good size. I think it was from the Melosis or from the Western Diamondback that Timmy had in his room. And just the size and girth. Just nuts. The girth alone compared from a Gaboon to a rattlesnake, even a good sized rattlesnake, is astounding. It's a little scary, honestly.
Yeah. And my big breeder female, she's probably right at 5 foot, and she's at least the thickness of, say, a cantaloupe, if that makes sense. And I only feed her a small rat once a week just because she just doesn't need that much food. You know, she's so fat reserved, and they retain their feces for a number of reasons, and you know, they only poop every so many weeks, so many months, and I don't want to overload her. But when I give her a small rat on tongs, her bite radius is so large that the fangs pass the rat, and they actually hook under her lower lip, and she basically puts the whole rat in her mouth and then swallows it. There's no like working the rat down. It's just bam, there it is. And then in two gulps, it's gone. So it's wild, man.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
I just remember taking one of the fangs and like holding it up to my hand and be like, oh, if it bit my hand, the fang would stick out the other side and it would be spraying venom like out the other side.
I might survive this, actually.
There's been people that have. Really? They got bit in just the right spot on the fleshiness of their hand where the fang went clear through and through.
Clear through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they got some residual necrosis at the bite site, but the venom actually injected out of their hand onto the floor. Wild.
That's, oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, it's already, it's already scary enough to think about being bitten by that animal. Yeah. But then to have it happen and you see what's supposed to enter your bloodstream.
Yeah.
Fuck that. That's all I can say is fuck that.
It's ominous, man. At times it is.
But I wish that like Cornuta was more available because like a incredible species.
I know. Oh.
And they used to be around. Like I remember them being around, not super common, but like fairly commonly available back in the day, but like not anymore.
You can get a captive bred Paracornuta out of Europe for about $2,000, maybe $2,100. So. And there's some rubidia floating around right now. They go for, again, $1,800 a pair or something like that. So there is some of the more dwarf bittus out there. They're few and far between because not enough people are keeping them and not enough people are breeding them. And that's why they demand a hefty price tag in that regard. So
Yeah. And if you're listening to this sometime in the crazy future, it is currently the beginning of 2024.
Yeah, there you go.
I remember when I went to see Steve and Dez and saw the Parviocula. I was like, oh man, those are really cool, man.
So, Rob, remember in the beginning of the show when you asked me about regrets?
Yes.
So I was working at a place that got a, air quotes, legit paperwork shipment from Kenya. And according to Stephen Spalls, there has only been one sighting confirmed of Parviocula on the north side of the border mountain range in Kenya. Mm-hmm. Everything else is in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Regardless, that was a species that I should have bought when I had the chance. And I said, ah, I'll get them on the next shipment. They're everywhere. They breed like weeds. More people will breed them. And no one ever did. And anyone who wants to see a really, really cool African viper, look up Bitis parviocula, the Ethiopian mountain adder. It is the size of a puff adder, but it's neon green and black and gold and awesome.
Yeah. Yep. It literally, I just remember walking past that enclosure and like stopping dead in my tracks. I was like, I think that it was just so eye catching to me. I was like, I think that I need that. Yeah. Like right now.
And I remember we didn't have a lot of them. We probably had 50, 60 of them on that one shipment. And they were very placid. They were very relaxed, and they ate right away. They're very opportunistic, and we kept them just like we kept gaboons. And we had little ones, we had big ones, and again, a phenomenal species that I wish more people kept, and I wish more people bred in captivity, because there's a lot to learn of those animals.
Yeah, man, I wish that there was people breeding them. I know that Steven's working on that, but like, man, I love those. Those are so freaking cool.
Yeah.
I didn't really think about it. I was like, you know, all of these species that I like, I'm like, oh man. And I'm like, okay, that's from Africa. Okay, that's from Africa. Okay, that's from Africa. Wait a second. That's from Africa.
Yeah, man. The best stuff.
Although, Waggleri, Subannulatus, Tropolemus stuff. Yes. Has a very deep place in my heart, and I need some of those in the worst kind of way.
I'll be honest, man. I've worked with a lot of them over the years. I've never kept them just because I know how hard they are, man. They're the emerald tree boa of venomous.
Of venomous, yeah.
You know, the metabolism is super slow. The environmental demands are extremely tedious. And I feel like if I didn't have a collection, it's one of those species where if I didn't have a collection, I only had maybe two or three of them, and that was it. It was the only animals I had. I could probably do okay with them, but I'm not willing to take them on in any regard, because I know I couldn't do it justice. I would be doing a disservice to the animal. So,
yeah.
But yeah, super cool species.
Mm-hmm. And then we can't go the episode without talking about Trans-Pecos copperheads and other Aegisterodon, because why would you? That I have seen some at the Venomous Expo that I've been to, the Greenville show here in North Carolina, and they have had them both times that I've gone, and I keep looking at it, and I'm like, oh man, those things are so freaking cool. I just love the Trans-Pecos look with the deep contrast. I just love things that have contrast, and like Trans-Pecos copperheads have incredible contrast to them.
Oh yeah. Between them and the Osage, like I'm a Trans-Pecos freak. I love West Texas. I keep Trans-Pecos rat snakes, as you well know, Rob. And I had to have the copperheads to go with the rat snakes. And when I have more black box enclosures decked out the way I want them, I'm probably going to do a cohab with an adult suboc and an adult Trans-Pecos rat, because I'm one girl heavy on the Trans-Pecos. So I might do that cohab and kind of see how it goes, because I think that would just be so cool, man. So
that would be pretty tight. Hell that would be pretty tight. I'm not going
to lie. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, man, the copperheads are great. You know, they're super easy species to keep. They're very low maintenance. They aren't a Kistrodon, so they like to poop every 10 minutes, much like many other colubrids that we keep. But in terms of venomous and like a good starter venomous, I try not to give starter venomous recommendations. But if you don't have mentorship, if you don't have someone that you can learn from, and you're going to dive in head first, a copperhead is a great species to keep where you can be completely hands off, only using snake hooks of appropriate length, and you can work with the animal and kind of get a feel for things. And there's still a danger factor there. You're not working with something harmless that's subconsciously in the back of your mind. Ah, if I get bit, what happens? Eh, whatever. No, this will definitively be not good.
Yeah.
and you still have that danger factor there, but you also get the uniqueness of the species. And because they are desert, arid, grassland, quasi-montane, if you will, they're super hardy. So yes. Great animals. Love them. Then I have a pair together right now. I don't know if they stuck, but we'll find out in a few months.
Ooh, hell yeah. Dude, that's awesome. I think that is often overlooked for the terms of like intro venomous species, because, you know, if you have a 3-foot long hook, it's very infrequently that you would be within the strike range of a copperhead if you're doing things the appropriate way, you know, the right way. You know, using a 3-foot hook, not sticking your hand inside of the enclosure, using your hook to open up the doors, using your hook to close the doors. It's very easy to stick to your protocol and keep yourself a very safe distance away from a copperhead, as opposed to almost any of the other species of venomous snakes that people get as their first venomous snake, you know, a monocle cobra, a western diamondback rattlesnake, like any of those. Yeah. At some point, it is going to get big enough where a 3-foot hook, you're still within the strike range at some point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a huge perk to the copperhead, too, aside from it being a more mild venom, it is still potentially lethal, people. But aside from that, it's a North American native, and the anti-venom that we use on that species is a polyvalent, which means it has multiple species used for that one antidote. And it's found throughout North America in thousands of hospitals. So if that is a consideration, which it should be, that aids in the education of that animal. It aids in the ability to keep that animal, because you have somewhat of a reassurance that you will get treatment and not die,
that you will save it in a or keep it in a safe manner, because it's one thing to keep things, but also to do so in a safe manner that mitigates the amount of you dying if something goes wrong.
And I think that is overlooked. Very much so. And in terms of like an easy to keep species, they are very forgiving, because we were talking about being desert and blah blah blah, but they usually don't ride a hook in the beginning. So it kind of gives you a workout, if you will, in terms of maintaining the animal on two sticks, for lack of a better word. And then as you interact with that animal more, they tend to become more tolerant and ride a hook really well. So as you're learning how to manipulate the animal with snake hooks, it's learning to be a cooperative specimen at the same time. So I like that about them.
Yeah, man. I wish that more people considered them. I think that a lot of people, when it comes to venomous, at least some of the people, they don't look at it as like lovingly or like with as much like admiration as they do a cobra or a Gaboon viper or, you know, any of the other species that people are free, you know, after the squams. People don't look at copperheads the same way, when in reality it's probably a much better intro than any of those other species, or even all of those species combined. I think that, you know, getting that foot in the door with those sets you up for at least, you know, some basis of knowledge and skill when it comes to extrapolating onto other species.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm all for getting babies and raising them up. That's like my MO. And people have kind of ridiculed me in a jovial manner of like, oh man, you still haven't bred those? It's been 5 years. And I'm like, yeah, man, slow game, right? Slow game. Mm-hmm. But talk about an animal that doesn't necessarily go through a full onto genetic change where the baby looks totally different than the adult, but you get the neon green tail when they're babies. You get the cross bands when they're babies. As they get older, they kind of fade and the pattern kind of separates. I mean, this is one of the Trans-Pecos that I had to take a picture, because it's on I don't keep them on paper towels, but for cleaning, I just kind of held them there. But dude, the contrast, it's like,
oh hell yeah, dude,
crazy contrast.
Oh,
That thing's silly, man.
It's like my pants just got tighter.
Nice, nice. It's almost Okati red. I love it.
Dude, that is phenomenal.
Did someone just hear? Did someone just hear a spring go doing?
Sorry, that was. I got the upgrade, and that's what it does now. So
nice, nice. I'd make a Wayne's World joke, but I know that most of the listeners probably don't know what that is. Yeah. Oh man.
So are there any species that you're like wanting to branch out and get now, or anything that's on your list for that you've moved recently? You're kind of setting up your room, kind of how you want it, getting adjusted to the move and how your room ebbs and flows. But is there any species that you're looking to add to?
The problem is I definitely want to get more sub-ox, more Trans-Pecos rat snakes. That's definitely on my radar. Just because I'm having so much fun with them, man. And they're such great animals. They're derpy looking, they're good eaters, they're personable, they're super friendly. But in terms of the venomous stuff, Eric Westmore, love you, brother. As far as the venomous stuff, the stuff I want is really expensive now. Yeah. So I'm going to kind of wait and see. And if some stuff falls in my lap or I get an opportunity or a window, if you will, then I might climb through that window on some of that stuff. But honestly, the next venture, and this is so left field for me because I'm such a snake guy, but Billy Hunt and I have been going pretty hardcore on toads. And I have an old gecko rack that I've slowly been upgrading the geckos out of. And I'm going to gut that rack. And I want to do some locality specific southern toads, man. Dude, I want to get some Carolina reds if I can. I want to get some panhandle blues. I want to get some my local funky, almost granite looking ones from Palm Beach County, Florida, and just get like one of these, two of those, and try my hand at some amphibians. I've always been apprehensive of it because of the water purity and humidity and blah blah blah. And I said, you know what? I've been keeping a small group of Bophotes bullingeri, the Egyptian green toads. They're a desert species of toad. So I'm like, all right, they can handle the heat, but so can Florida southern toads. So as long as I have the humidity in their tub enclosures, they should be fine in the desert room. So that's going to probably be the next venture, to be honest, which is so left field. Yeah, you know?
No, that's awesome. I remember when I moved down here, I was just like hiking different areas and different parks and stuff. And I started seeing these toads that are like bright flaming red. And I'm
dude,
what the hell is that? I've never seen a toad that red before. And it's not like they're uncommon. They're just like all over the freaking place.
Yeah, man. Dude, those Carolina reds, they get me every time, man. Gorgeous.
They're so freaking cool.
Gorgeous toads.
And Carolina would be producing some red herps, you know?
Yeah. Pygmies and toads. I love it. I just did a trip with the NPR boys to North Florida, and you know, we kind of venture off in little groups as we're herping, and Nipper and I, this was his first time herping the East Coast of the United States. He's from London.
Heck yeah.
And dude, we got all six native species of Florida toad in a week. Dude, and I feel like that really set me into like the toad-tastic world of amphibians.
it's totally actually, incredible.
Somebody totally clip that. Cool.
Yeah, right. It's my fiance's slang. Every time I'm like, babe, look at this toad, she goes, it's toad-tastic. It's totally awesome.
Yes.
So yeah, that's and it's good, man. And to see a tall, skinny British guy trying to catch a cane toad in the cane fields of South Florida, him running around the car trying to catch it, priceless. Because I know he's going to listen to this later. So,
oh man.
Yeah. You know, it's one thing to get like a little piece of it, but getting the totality of it is a lot better, you know?
Damn. Oh, man. So,
oh, gosh.
Dude, I am all about that. That's awesome. I'm going to have to send you some toad pictures because I've seen some really cool toads here in North Carolina since I've been down here.
Yeah,
but I always just like catch them. I'm like, oh, hey, look at you. And then I put them down and I just like keep going on my day. So.
Yeah. And dude, you guys get oak toads up by you, right?
I believe so, yeah.
I'm pretty sure, I don't know how high up it goes, but there's I don't know if it's like coastal South Carolina, but there's an oak toad where the stripe is red instead of white. And like, I want to see that. That just sounds cool.
So. That does sound really cool. Yeah. I think the ones that I've got around me are the white striped ones. If it's the toad that I'm thinking of, because there's a species that comes by here that has a really, you know, decently colored stripe that goes from the eye back down.
Yeah. But now this is the one that goes right down the vertebral stripe of the back.
Okay.
They're super tiny, though, like this big.
Maybe not the same species then that I'm thinking of.
But yeah, man,
I'll have to do some research. I'm not as well versed on the frogs and toads
stuff. That's the fun of it, is because I've been so obsessed with snakes and a handful of lizards over the years that this is like the new knowledge part, you know, like this is we're always thirsty for more herpetological knowledge, and I don't know anything about amphibians, so this is like the whole new venture for me. So aside from a handful of snake species and some geckos that I'm gonna hopefully get in the distant future, I get to buy more books.
Yeah,
I get to buy more frog and toad books. Like, who's better than that? Right? So,
hell yeah,
that is awesome. Yeah, it definitely helps when you go to expo and you're like, I don't really have more time to spend on more animals, but I can do some reading at the end of my night on a new book.
Oh, wait, I thought you were talking about buying books at the expo.
that's what I'm saying. Yeah. If you go to the expo, you're like, I don't really have more time to buy a new animal. So instead of buying the animal, I'm going to buy new books. And then, you know, in my spare time, while I'm winding down for the night, instead of cleaning, I can be reading books about different species.
Exactly.
Right. And then you end up getting new species. And then...
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's how it rolls.
It's a cycle. It's a cycle. It's like a circle. It's a vicious cycle.
Truly vicious.
yeah, right.
Dude, we gotta go herping. I gotta get down there. It's gotta happen.
Yes.
I was talking about me and Jeremy have been talking again recently. It's like, we need to do another one of those Florida trips where we do a little, like a day or two down in South Florida, and then hit Central Florida, and then hit Northern Florida, and span it out over, I don't know, a week or something, you know, 5 days where we just get out there and do some herping, because I'm fiending. I need to get out and herp more. Like, don't get me wrong, I really enjoy herping here, but seeing wild cottonmouths and all these different water snakes and all these different, you know, seeing alligators and all that stuff, I need it in my life in the worst kind of way.
And see, you're killing me, because I love Ambystoma. I've never seen one of those in the wild, and you're just coming up left and right with them suckers.
Well, dude, bro, you come up here in February, March, or in like October, November, and I will show you like 30 marbled salamanders in a day. And there's another place where the last time we went out, and we saw 12 spotted salamanders in one day.
Wow. Yeah.
Freaking.
That's awesome.
It's getting close to the temperature now where they're going to start going back underground. But spring and fall, you come out here, I'll show you some freaking salamanders, man. Because the last, when we found those spotted salamanders, we were losing our mind, because me and Kristen are out there and we're rolling logs. We're like, oh, they're spotted. And we take it out and take a million pictures of it. And then we're like, okay, man, that was awesome. And then we're walking around, oh, let's check on that logo. Another spotted. Oh my God, it's so great. And then we're like shaking each other and like so excited. And, you know, in Massachusetts, like, there are spotted salamanders up there, but I'd seen like, you know, maybe a dozen of them over my life, you know, seeing them, and, you know, one here and one there. And like, just the mindset of when you want to see salamanders is not when snakes are out. And so I'm like, oh, it's like 50 degrees and it's raining outside. I really don't want to be outside right now. But the salamanders are like, they're all hyped. That night that we went road cruising for salamanders, I think you saw like 10 spotted salamanders just cruising that night. And it was just like, you know, it's steadily raining and we're out there, we're like, we're getting wet, but we're seeing lots of salamanders, so it's worth it.
Yeah, man. Grab your poncho and your gloves and your galoshes, and who's better than you?
We were ill prepared. We were out there in sweatshirts and jeans, so we were getting rained on, but the salamanders were worth it. So it was okay.
We got to get you guys down here and we'll hit some of the WMAs and find you some sirens.
Dude, I would love to see some of those.
That would be badass, dude.
Yeah, man.
A little bit scary, but that's cool. I heard they bite really hard.
Well, no, you're talking about Infuma.
Yes, Infuma. Yeah, Infuma. Sorry.
Yeah, Infuma get way bigger than the Infuma. They'll take your toe off, but no, yeah. Sirens are they're singing songs, man. They're elegant. Love them.
They're calling me to South Florida.
That's it, man. That is it. Yeah, we definitely do need to plan that trip, Rob.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think that this weekend, I think it's going to be this weekend. Yeah, it's probably going to be this weekend that I'm going to be going down to Black Box. So I'm going to be making the trip down to Georgia. And then last weekend, I was down in South Carolina. So I had 8 hours in the car last Saturday. And then I'm about to do another 10 hours in the car this weekend from Georgia and back. But so maybe not the following weekend, but maybe a couple weekends after that, we can figure something out.
That's fair, dude. Yeah, no rush.
Yeah,
no rush. Remember, it just has to happen, but no rush. Yes.
The only time you can't herp in Florida
is around Daytona.
Yeah, well, obviously that. But no, the only time you can't herp South Florida, where I'm at, you know, south of Big O, is January, February. Other than that, the whole year you'll find stuff.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, Daytona is going to happen this year, so I'm definitely going to be doing some early morning herping again, because seeing those pygmies, man, before we left was really freaking nice.
Is it bad that I'm really excited that I'll finally be able to go to a show and not have to answer all the "Where's Rob?" questions?
Yes. Yes.
Bruh. You're
plaguing me for the last couple of times.
Well, I should be at this. I'll be at this Daytona. And then I would like to make Tinley happen, but alternatively, I would much prefer to go to Southeast Arizona for Sky Island Rattlesnake. Yeah. So
I think
that the Rattlesnakes are going to win out this year, unless I can pull something off and win the lottery or something. But
dude, Sky Islands will change you, man.
I have a feeling.
It's a biblical thing, bro. It's awesome. Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely awesome. Mm-hmm. It touches your soul, man. Like, just like top of the islands to bottom, like the lowlands and the prairie and just the open desert, man. And it's unlike anything you've ever seen. So definitely go.
Yeah, I need to see Melosis in the worst kind of way. And then Willard Eye and Lepidus are like, you know, some clobs are very, very high on my list. I think Willard Eye are like my holy grail for American species, like U.S. species. So
yeah, man,
it's got to happen. It's just,
I've been
putting it off for too long.
When you find a Willy, man, it'll change you. It really will. Mm-hmm. It's like a... it's a spiritual thing, man. Yeah. You know, and you can't pick it up, you can't move it, you can't touch it, it's all protected. But just to be there and like just to hear that tiny little rattle and just be in its presence and know that you're at the top of a mountain that hasn't changed for millennia, and it's just above the world, man, with this tiny little rattlesnake. It's spiritual, man. I get choked up, man. It's crazy. If you go to venomexchangeradio.com, the banner of our website, selfless plug, venomexchangeradio.com. If you go to the banner of it, it's the Willard Eye that me and the NPR boys got. So
yeah,
super cool.
That's like, I already know, I can feel it. Like, I'm going to get choked up when I
see it. Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah, absolutely, man.
It's just such a cool species. Gotta happen.
It's like what we were talking about before the show with like the beam of light, you know?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. The skies have opened, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. That's it. Oh, I love it. Those stupid little rattlesnakes.
Oh, man. I need them in my life.
That's why I know I'm just going to get like a million messages from Rob. It's just going to like, I'm not going to be able to understand a single word.
Yeah. Oh, just
coming out of his mouth.
Well, and the best part is you're going to get spammed all these messages at like 4 in the morning, because he'll send them at, you know, 6 o'clock at night when they found it. but he's on the top of the mountain, so it's going to take that long, and you're 3 hours behind, so you're going to get him at 4 a.m. going, what the hell?
Yep. Yeah. Basically what's going to happen.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it.
Yeah, that's it, man.
It'll be worth it.
1,000%. Well, you just got to, Jeremy, you got to go with him, man.
I mean, I'm down, but I, yeah. if it's Tinley time, I can't do it because I have to work at Tinley.
Yeah. So then you make it, you know, a couple days after.
If it's not Tinley time, I'm down.
Yeah. And like, especially like you two as co-hosts, man, like it's a bonding moment. Oh, it'll be great.
Hell yeah, dude. I mean, I'm fucking down. I mean, you don't have to say much to convince
me. Twist my arm. Like,
yeah, yeah. Oh, we're going to go here for reptiles? I don't know, man.
Jeremy, I'm just letting you know now, I'm only going to sleep for 2 hours a night. That's just what it's going to be. I'm going to be road cruising and fucking...
That's going to be what makes me say no.
Yeah, well, dude, that's the
me
way
and Rob Stone got to get out there, man. Because I hear the stories about Rob Stone, and I'm like, oh, me and him would get along on a fucking herping trip. Because
for sure.
I don't eat, man. I'm just like so focused. I'm like, oh, shit, it's already been 8 hours. I didn't even realize I was too busy looking for rattlesnakes. So let's stop and get a quesadilla real quick, and then let's get back on the trail.
That's it, man. That's 1,000%. Where's the nearest taco truck? And that's the thing is, we told Rob, look, man, we love you, but if you're hungry, that means we're starving. So you should probably start heading back, you know? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, by the time Rob realizes he's hungry, I've stopped on 6 different rocks and sat down and had something to eat.
Yeah, man. The dude's got a metabolism like a hummingbird. It's awesome. Yeah.
I literally have an alarm set on my watch at 1 p.m. every day to remind myself, hey, you got to stop and eat, because otherwise I just don't. I just like forget completely, and I'll be like going through my work day, and I'm like, oh, it's 5 o'clock. What have I eaten today? Let's see. I had a bottle of water, a bottle of Dr. Pepper, and that is it. I have not eaten anything today. I need to go find some food right quick.
Yeah, bro.
Yep.
That's it. That's herping, baby. Yeah, man. Good stuff.
I feel like that's how it's going to be. So.
100%.
Oh, shit. Okay, well, we've run a little bit past our time, but thank you so much for being on, Phil. We do have one question that we ask every guest at the end of our episodes, and that question is, what in the realm of reptiles, be it something that you're personally working on or something that you've seen on the internet that somebody else is doing or something that's scientific that's been discovered recently, what has you excited about reptiles right now?
Our ability to share data in our husbandry. The fact that everyone's got a Govee, everyone's on the Wi-Fi, as I say, on the line, right? And the fact that I can look at a weather station in Luxor, Egypt, and I can get an idea of what's happening at that exact moment in time. I can set my thermostat in my enclosures to vary the amount of UV that Luxor, Egypt is getting right now. I can cool things down, I can heat things up, and I can share all this data with everyone else in my community. That to me is fascinating. And I love where we're going with the full spectrum lighting and the different bulbs and LEDs and ventilation. And I feel like our husbandry it's not at its peak. Oh, but it's climbing real steep, real fast. And I absolutely love that. I love where companies like Black Box, like, forget the sponsorship, man. It's an awesome company with awesome enclosures. 100%. Right. 100%. And they're catering to what we as keepers are telling them. Hey, we want this much substrate dam. I told them, I was like, look, I want your exact cage, but I want sliders with a venomous lock that doesn't have a stick on nonsense ratchet thing that's going to break in a month. And they did it. They did pin locks for me. Like the fact that we have the ability to communicate our husbandry findings as well as our field research findings to accentuate and augment our keeping and our sharing of these amazing animals, that to me is fantastic right now in our day of age, in our era, if you will.
Yes.
That to me, the communication of what we're doing is awesome.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the important reasons why having a podcast like ours, a podcast like NPR, a podcast like Venomous Exchange Radio and the Herpetic Ulcer Network to archive and save that information for people in the future to learn from and to grow their knowledge and to expand their field of view, so that people can learn from our mistakes and from the things that we've learned and build upon that to expand and grow. I think that that is like super important. I think that's really cool. One of the things I feel like I maybe bothered them, but Owen and Eric, when they have a Herp History show, I message them afterwards. I'm like, thank you so much for having this person on. I learned so much. I need to go back and listen to it again. And like, this just happened the other day. Richard Ross, the Blue Bible, just passed away. And he was on there. And now that information is preserved. And I know that they probably wish that they could have had more conversation with him and was able to preserve more of that. But just even just having that ability to have had him on in the past to preserve some of that information, because, you know, all these people have so many stories of where they've been and the things that they've learned in their travels and they're keeping, you know, we could never bring all of that down and save all of that. But in doing episodes like Herp History and like the stuff you're doing with Venomous Exchange Radio, preserves pieces of that for people in the future that they can learn from. And I think that's super important.
Well said, man. Well said. And don't feel bad about bothering them with questions on Herp History, because those two guys, not only are they Eric and Rob specifically have been communicating with their herper keeper friends in Australia, but also with plant people, because the Aussie animals they're keeping, they're filling the enclosure with native Aussie plants and trying to get the soil right. And I hope I didn't let some kind of cat out of the bag by saying that. But just going back to the communication, like everything from having Ross on a show and not just talking about the Blue Bible, but all of those experiences and the ability to share those experiences and share the knowledge so that we can all be better keepers, we can all take better care of our animals, and we can all help the animals both in the home and in the wild. And I'm with you, man. I love it.
Yeah. Hell yeah. It's just little tiny steps moving forward. And we don't feel like they're big steps until we look back at how far we've come. And we're looking at radiant heat panels and UV lighting inside of enclosures.
Dude, I had a heat rock.
Bioactive. Yep. Oh, I used heat rocks for a really long time, man. And there was ways I actually found to modify the heat rocks so that they were more effective for me and less of a risk, but I still used them, you know?
Yeah.
And coming from that to where I'm at right now, where I'm, you know, stacking up scrub cages next to me currently, and reproducing these snakes that I dreamed about keeping 10 years ago.
Which, by the way, you get all the golf claps in the world, my friend, because you are killing it, bro. Killing it.
I am trying. I still don't feel that I am, you know, I've got the craziest imposter syndrome when it comes to that sort of thing, because I feel like I should be more accomplished at this point in my life, you know, but it is what it is. And I do appreciate the things that I've done so far. And if I die today, just know that I lived a pretty fun life and I did some fun stuff. So I don't.
Every Somalia win that you have is a Somalia win for all of us.
Yes.
That's it.
And me and Stephen Cush are talking all the freaking time, throwing ideas back and forth at each other and fucking trying to figure out like what we're doing here, what little things that I'm seeing, what little things that he's seeing, and how they're different and how certain things are the same. And, you know, that is one of the things that he brings up and talks about a lot. It's like the old guard, people like guarding information and keeping it away from people, and they learn something and they have a win and they don't want anyone else to have it. And me and him are both of the mindset of fuck that, man. What the fuck are you doing? Come on. If more people are successful, everybody wins. There is not a situation where if I'm not successful breeding scrubs, it makes it better for him breeding scrubs. It's just not real. It's fake. It's made up. It's based on ego and people thinking that they deserve to have something and nobody else should have it. And that needs to be gone. We do not need that in this hobby. everybody should be able to enjoy this hobby. I don't think that we should be in any sort of position to be shutting people out of this.
Agreed.
And in an era where I can share information with people from Australia, from West Papua, from Africa, from South America, in an instant, I can be talking to people from all of those continents at the same exact time. We shouldn't be gatekeeping information, and we should be working together to make things better. You know,
I'm with you 1,000%, man.
Hell yeah, dude.
Phil, I love you. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for coming on this evening, man.
Yeah, man.
I can't wait to see you at Daytona. I'm going to give you a giant hug.
For sure. From both of you. I want both at the same time.
Yes.
Neither shoulder. That's it. I'm there.
I'm just going to like lay my head on.
I'm shorter than both of you, so it'll be comfortable.
we got a picture where we're like holding you, like he's gonna be under one leg, I'll be underneath the other one, and we're both holding you up.
I'm hefty. We might have to have a couple of the guys to help.
Let's do it. Let's get Smitty in there. Come on, buddy.
Yeah. I'm game. I'm down. I love it.
Oh man,
I love it.
So if people want to follow you and see the things that you're working with and the things that you're doing, you've got like 47 things that you got to list right now. So you better just get started and explaining to people. So,
easiest way to get a hold of me is on Instagram. It's knobtails.ig. That's where we post, but where I post the Snakes and Stogies stuff, as well as the Herpetoculture Network on Instagram and Facebook. And then Venom Exchange Radio, venomexchangeradio.com, Venom Exchange Radio on all the podcast platforms, as well as the Herpetoculture Network on all the podcast platforms, and Venom Exchange Radio on YouTube. There's not much, but we're working on it. So that's it.
And you've got venomous handling courses or like videos on there.
Yeah,
as well.
I started to do what we called venomous etiquette videos, which I'm going to work more on. It's tough. While I was making the first couple of videos, we learned that nobody wants to watch a 40-minute video on safe handling. They want 15 seconds of some guy almost losing his life.
Almost getting bit, yeah.
So I'm probably going to chop up some of the stuff I have, make it a little shorter, make it a little more friendly, and then try and put some tips out there and some my opinion as advice, and try and steer some people in the right direction, and then just try and get some more knowledge out there. So that's the goal.
Oh, yeah. I was literally thinking about that, and I was like, when I start to get, when I move counties and I'm able to branch out into Venomous, I would love to help you with cultivating some content for that and safe handling and all that sort of stuff, because that's one of the things that I'm very passionate about, is safe handling of venomous snakes. And there's lots of ways to have interesting conversations and to work with venomous snakes and have it be interesting while still also being safe. Yeah. And I think that people who are riding the death, trying to catch the bullet train to death, they get the views, but honestly, they are doing everyone a disservice in what they're doing.
Yeah. The people that really want to learn the proper technique, the proper safe handling protocol, they're going to come to people like us. And that makes me happy, you know? So the least we can do is give them a tidbit of knowledge to help them be safe and to help them have a better time, a better experience for both themselves and the animal. And that's the goal of it, man. And if two people watch, if nobody watches it, who cares? At least we did it. So.
Yeah. And the resource has to be there for people to be able to search for it, because if people are searching and the only thing that they're finding is the Nine Finger Gang, then that's how they're going to think that it should be done. And ultimately, there's other ways to do things that are safer and better for everybody.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed.
Absolutely.
Cool. Thank you so much for being on, man. Yeah,
thank
I love
you so much, man. This was a blast.
I loved it. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Good episode. Yeah. And we will catch you guys next time. Make sure you check out blackboxcages.com. Get yourself a rack, get yourself an enclosure, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.
Bye.